Almost 2 years ago, we brought you a program on the crisis of modern journalism. It was ominously called The Post-Journalistic World. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Much has changed since that show went to air, and not for the good. Major media organisations are still shrinking, particularly in the English-speaking world, and as a result, journalists are rapidly declining in number. As far as circulation figures are concerned, it's perhaps instructive to note that News Corporation Australia late last year decided to withdraw its publications from the country's major circulation audit. Desperate to chase readers and viewers online, news organisations have in recent times turned increasingly to third-party platforms for help. But that strategy is now coming into question. Today on Future Tense, media and the difficulties and dangers of outsourcing distribution.
Hi, I'm Lindsay, a lead digital marketing strategist here at RevLocal, and this is your marketing refresh.
Our tale begins with a seemingly innocent adjustment.
In case you missed it, Facebook recently announced that the company is changing its newsfeed algorithm. Mark Zuckerberg announced this change, stating he wants time spent on Facebook to be more meaningful. So the social network will begin to reduce the reach of businesses and brands and put more emphasis on friends and family. Zuckerberg even said...
And the businesses and brands who immediately began panicking after that announcement included quite a few news organisations, many of whom have become comfortable in recent years with the idea of giving over control of the distribution of their content to the Facebook juggernaut. Some of them are now crying foul, but Matthew Ingram, the chief digital writer at the Columbia Journalism Review, says Facebook's about face has to be read in context.
I feel as though, you know, what they were trying to do was to make the network more useful for users, and based on the information that they saw, you know, from what people were doing and how long they were spending and what they were clicking on, they probably decided that news was not getting as much engagement as they thought. And I think it's possible that on top of that, the company might have thought, you know, news is a huge problem. It raises issues of fake news and misinformation. It draws attention from Congress. And so it's a huge pain in a way. And if it isn't driving as much engagement with users, then maybe it isn't worth having that much in the newsfeed. And one thing media companies, I think, have to keep reminding themselves is that Facebook is not a media entity and actually has no interest per se in sort of journalism the way media organizations do. Facebook is a revenue-driven, you know, entity designed to keep people on the platform and using the platform for all sorts of other purposes. And so it's going to make decisions that make sense from that perspective and for its bottom line, regardless of what impact it has on news companies or news and journalism in general.
In that sense, it's the news organisations that are suffering from this change. It's their own fault in a lot of ways for being over-reliant. But it's a difficult environment, isn't it, given the amount of domination that, say, Facebook and Google have?
I mean, that's the problem. It's not as though there is a single evil company to blame. And it's true that lots of media companies effectively handed over their business to Google and Facebook because they didn't pay as much attention to the online market as they should have, or didn't do it as quickly as they should have. They failed to adapt. They failed to, in particular, pursue mobile as quickly or as efficiently. And so when Facebook and Google came along and said, look, we can do this for you. You can become part of our AMP project, or you can be part of Instant Articles, or you can just put all your stuff on our platform. That was a lot easier and cheaper than doing it themselves. And so lots of media companies decided, well, heck, we might as well just let Facebook do it and we'll just, you know, take the revenue. And the problem when you do that is you hand over effectively the power over your future and your business to a third party. And that third party makes decisions that are in its own interest, not in your interest.
And the cost of that over-reliance has been considerable.
The average for lots of online sites was that Facebook was driving 30 to 40% of traffic. That's a massive amount for a single entity. Now, some of that has gone away because of the changes they've made to the algorithm. I've seen evidence from analytics companies that Google has actually increased its sort of share compared to what it used to be. It used to be below Facebook. So there's some jockeying going on there. And Facebook has kind of, it's lost a bit of its dominance because of the changes it's made to the algorithm, but it's still a significant driver for a lot of sites. And the problem is, if Facebook's changes have gotten you thinking about your reliance on the company, how do you replace that 20 or 30%? There's no other entity that's going to be able to come up with that. So you have to either figure out how to live without that, or you have to kind of do a lot of other things on the side and hope that they add up to the same kind of audience share you had before.
For some small publishers, that task of rebuilding is all but impossible. Gabrielle Boland is the Content Strategy and Communications Manager at NewsWhip, an organisation that specialises in helping firms grow their user engagement. Boland cites the online publisher Little Things as an instructive example.
Little Things, they were Facebook's sweetheart. They were quoted in some case studies on Facebook, and they were doing amazingly. They built their entire business around Facebook. They had millions of followers, millions of video views monthly. But with the Facebook algorithm change, and this is actually a trend that had been coming for quite some time, their traffic really plummeted. More so in August of last year, it started to decline, but this last change just really was the final nail in the coffin for them. And we've seen publishers reacting to this in different ways. Mostly, they're starting to diversify a lot more. General news publishers, when we look at the data of their social engagements, haven't really been hit as hard, but definitely those viral, clickbaity or engagement-baity publishers are starting to see some more declines. And it's interesting because Facebook is prioritizing family and friend content, and they're prioritizing content that drives a good deal of comments, but it seems like Facebook is still kind of trying to figure out what they are to people, where they stand in the media. They just announced that they're going to have a breaking news tag that publishers can apply to content, I think once every 6 hours or 12 hours, something like that, to kind of help news get back into the news feed. And they just ended their Explore test that they were doing in a few countries where they moved all publisher feed into a totally separate tab. So there's a lot of unsteady ground this year for sure. So publishers are trying all sorts of things. There's more traffic coming from Google now. You know, they're really building out strong Instagram audiences. They're trying even things like Musical.ly, which is really big with Generation Z. So it's a lot of experimentation, but you can't rely on one platform to be where your sun rises and sets.
It sounds almost obvious, doesn't it, that you wouldn't put, you know, as they say, all your eggs in one basket. But when you look at the way the world is at the moment, you know, it's understandable, isn't it, for a publisher like Little Things to prioritise a platform like Facebook, given its size, and then also given the size of Google as well, because the two of them, Facebook and Google, are enormously important in terms of distribution, aren't they?
Absolutely. They've been huge distributors for publisher content, especially given that this is where people are spending the majority of their time online now. Over half of American adults get their news from Facebook or from other social media sources. So it makes sense for a smaller publisher to kind of ride the wave of a big platform to reach audiences where they already are. It's just, you know, you're not owning that space then. And we see this with another viral publisher, Now This, which famously ditched its homepage and instead focused only on specific Facebook pages it was building out. And now post-algorithm change, they've revived their homepage.
And yet, even that kind of move is difficult, isn't it? Because our consumption habits really have changed. You only just have to hop on a bus or a train to see people using their smartphones for information and entertainment. So everything really these days is directed towards social media platforms, not towards company websites.
Yeah, and then that leads to the whole, you know, rise of filter bubbles and algorithms kind of keeping people separate from each other and reading their own version of the news, which confirms what they want to read. And that makes us very vulnerable to things like, you know, in the U.S. with the Russian interference in the election or other fake news creators. So in our database, and I was just looking at this today, one of the top authors who's driving the most Facebook engagements is from the site Your Newswire, which is just a blatantly fake news site that kind of spurs fear and outrage from its articles. So yeah, publishers are contending with this on the platforms, and that's kind of what they have had to do because, like you said, no one's going to their websites necessarily. People have very small attention spans these days. We're just kind of passively scrolling in the newsfeed, which is something Mark Zuckerberg really wants to get rid of. And that's why he's focusing on content that creates comments. Sadly for publishers, that means that will have to be kind of provocative content a lot of times. Again, in our analysis, we see that hyper-partisan publishers are still doing really well because they're posting stuff that is inciting people rather than just getting them to genuinely share and comment and interact.
A statistic I saw recently said that 85% of what's being shared on social media is being shared by people who haven't bothered to read the thing they're sharing.
Gautam Mishra is a media analyst and former director of strategy, data and research at Fairfax Media. He's also the CEO of a service called Inkle, a news aggregation site that's partnered with quality news publishers like The Washington Post and The Economist. It charges readers for content and splits that profit with the publishers themselves. The days of not charging for news, says Gautam Mishra, must come to an end.
The issue is also that, to a certain extent, the industry has been able to avoid facing the central problem that it's experiencing, which is this loss of revenue that you alluded to earlier. You know, to a certain extent, having free distribution coming in through Facebook and Google has actually been bad for the industry because they've not had to confront their revenue challenge as urgently as they would have otherwise. And so to the extent that publishers look at this and say, okay, well, let's go back to first principles and how do we ensure that the journalism, the cost of the journalism can actually be fully met without relying on other platforms like Facebook and Google, I think that's ultimately going to bear out to be a positive shift, but it's going to be painful in the next year or two for a number of publishers.
But increasing consumer revenue has proved difficult for those organizations in an environment where there is so much free news to try and raise subscription levels, for instance, is a tricky thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is also, but it is a transient problem. I mean, to a certain extent, this is a problem of the industry's own making because, you know, if you don't give all your content away for free, then it's obviously doesn't have that same sense of, you know, ubiquity and commoditization. And certainly a lot of publishers have started to restrict access to their content for free. And I think from a reader's perspective, this is a very positive change because one of the challenges I think as a reader of news that we face is just not being able to tell what's real and what's fake. And a lot of that goes back, you know, to this fallacy that we all bought into, which is that a world without price is a utopian world where everything would be wonderful. In reality, price actually plays a very important role in our society because it's a marker for quality. You can judge by the price of a product how high the quality is and what you're paying for, really. And that's really what's happening in news now, where the organizations that invest very heavily to create high-quality news are saying, well, you can't have this for free because there's a cost to produce this. And really, this is not the same as what you can get for free. And I think readers are starting to understand that. It takes time. It took time in music, it took time in video, it takes time in any market to change. But I do think it's a necessary change for the industry to go through, both for the publishers and for the readers.
So in one sense, the shock of what's happened with Facebook, and Facebook isn't the only distribution platform, of course, but it's an enormous one and it's got lots of media. The shock of that could potentially be a good thing for the industry overall in the future.
Absolutely. You know, one way that we sometimes think about this problem is the main way in which an article or a piece of journalism is valued today is by how many clicks it gets in the online space. And the problem with that model is that it's very easily subverted. As we've seen over the last few years, by creating fake news, by sensationalizing headlines, by focusing on celebrity stories and various other things, it's very easy to trick people into just clicking on one story or another. And so in our world where, you know, really clicks are the only way you can determine the value of a story, it creates a very confusing and noisy view of the world for anyone who's reading the news. And so this new world where value is more clearly measured by what people are actually willing to pay for, I think that's a much better signal of quality. And as a result, we'll see a reduction in the sense of noise that exists in the world today, which I think is actually really much needed for all of us.
So a rationalization, a shakeup in that sense.
Yes, absolutely.
So major publishers, major news organizations then have to start rebuilding their brands and really working at trying to make them profitable from a subscriber perspective. How are the big players in Google and Facebook, though, going to respond to that?
Yes, it's interesting. So I think there'll be different responses from all the different platforms. So Facebook obviously is, you know, de-emphasizing how much news it provides in the feed. So I don't think it's going to have as big a role to play in this shift. But for its part, it is working with publishers and saying it wants to help publishers grow subscriptions. I think Google has a bigger role to play in this because they obviously are also a big funnel for news audiences, you know, that come in via a Google search. But importantly, companies like Google and Apple also have a lot of credit card information, so they can make it easier for someone to sign up for a subscription to start paying. And so certainly all of these companies are making, you know, very positive statements about supporting the industry shift to subscriptions and building a model there.
Now, all of that probably makes sense, but a major reason why so many news and media organizations decided to chase the seemingly easier option of third-party distribution in the first place was because it's proved so difficult to increase subscriptions.
If you're the New York Times or the Washington Post or, you know, The Economist or The Guardian, or you've got a big name, lots of people have heard of you, they probably, you know, want to give you a little bit of money, even if they don't read you all the time, because they think you're valuable or you do a good job or they've at least heard of you. In some senses, it's easier to be either huge with a sort of global brand or to be tiny with a sort of niche brand. So there are lots of individuals and small media entities that are making a living purely on subscriptions because they focus on a specific subject area or they focus on a specific geographical area. I'm thinking of even things like the Texas Tribune. You know, it derives a huge amount of revenue from donations and foundations, and it's expanding. ProPublica is expanding. So there are media organizations that can do that. The question is whether there are enough of them. So the hard part is what I call the sort of valley of death is the middle. So if you're tiny and focused, you probably have a shot. And if you're large and have a huge brand, you probably have a shot at survival or success. But if you're in the middle, you're not really big enough to reach a broad audience or to have the brand that has that kind of power. But you probably aren't as focused on a specific market as you need to be. And sort of, I'm thinking of mid-sized metro papers in the US. A lot of them were owned by chains. A lot of them sort of became homogenized products filled with wire copy, generic stories from here or there. You know, that's not going to drive anyone to subscribe. So I'm not sure what the future looks like for those papers. I mean, the layoffs, there was a whole round at a couple of U.S. papers just today. One of them, I think, has something like their newsroom is less than one-fifth the size of what it used to be. So you've got these newsrooms that used to try and cover, you know, a fairly large geographical area, cover the state house, cover local politics, and yet they're spread so thin it's almost impossible to do. And so to convince someone to subscribe to that is going to be an impossible task.
It's not all doom and gloom. So we aren't seeing declines for every single publisher. We're seeing some publishers are actually increasing their engagements. They're increasing how many links are being shared on Facebook. So that's a really positive trend to see. And some of these smaller publishers that do have extremely loyal followings around very niche offerings are kind of unchanged by this algorithm change because their audiences are actively seeking them out. So I think that's something that publishers of every size are going to have to look at and kind of try and figure out how they can replicate it for themselves.
This is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. Today, the future of news media in an age dominated by third-party distribution. One of the big surprises of the past year has been the way the digital darlings of the media business have also started to see a turn in their fortunes.
In the quickest summary, what did you uncover?
So there's this insane story in the Indian media last year that a lot of the
sites like BuzzFeed and Vice were being hailed as the future of news not so long ago, and BuzzFeed in particular had a significant influence on the shape of news presentation with its clickbait tactics and use of listicles. But now they're starting to look like legacy media. Both missed their revenue targets last year and have been laying off staff.
You know, at first when they came out, they were very trendy and people wanted to click on the interesting content. And now that the platforms are going away from that altogether, I think they are going to have to refine their footing, much like the traditional publishers had to do. So now in our data analysis, we're seeing breaking news stories almost do better than some of these publishers who are struggling against both them and then these viral pages like Unilad or the Lad Bible that just republish other content, even just user content, and get quick wins.
I mean, there was a time when venture capitalists convinced themselves that companies like Mashable and BuzzFeed and even Vice were going to be able to grow at, you know, double-digit rates because they either knew something about the way the market functioned or they were able to tap into technologies that allowed them to take advantage of, you know, digital infrastructure in a way that other companies couldn't. So BuzzFeed was said to have an understanding of the way that content was shared that would allow them to build an advertising business that would be worth the types of multiples that venture capitalists like to see. I don't think that belief exists anymore, because I think it's been shown that Google and Facebook's power over the digital advertising market primarily benefits Google and Facebook. And so if you're a company that relies on sort of pennies from Facebook in return for your content, that's not a great strategy for building the kind of long-term value or the kind of even short-term value that venture capitalists like to see. So they kind of convinced themselves that media companies, which venture capitalists typically don't like to invest in because they're too slow growing, they convinced themselves that these companies were different, that they were sort of tech/media companies, and therefore they were worth more. But I'm not convinced that that's the case anymore.
And with Facebook and Google combined accounting for between 60 to 70% of the digital ad market, in the US at least, that dominance isn't likely to decrease anytime soon, is it?
It certainly doesn't feel that way. And in particular, their control over what's called programmatic advertising, I think we can expect that to continue or even increase. So the kind of ads that are driven by automated bidding and automated ad swapping markets that all take place based on algorithms where human beings aren't even involved, you know, they effectively control that business, and there's no reason why that won't continue. I mean, there could be a company that we've never heard of could think of something different or come up with some new technology and disrupt that market, but it certainly doesn't look like that's coming anytime soon. So the only thing left is the theory, I guess, that TV advertising, the type of sort of brand value, mass marketing advertising that you see on TV shows, that is moving to the internet, and that those sort of hundreds of billions of dollars are available for someone to take advantage of, and that Google and Facebook aren't particularly good at that type of advertising. I've heard that theory. So whether media companies can take advantage of that remains to be seen.
So the take-home message so far: Google and Facebook combined dominate distribution online and account for up to 70% of digital ad revenues. So any news or media organisation trying to make money from advertising without involving either of those two giants is going to be pushing it uphill, including companies like BuzzFeed and Vice. Secondly, Facebook's recent algorithm change shows that the big tech organisations have no real commitment to quality news and are actually happy to jettison the news publishers they've courted when they deem it necessary to do so for their own economic interests. And all of that together is why our three guests today believe that 2018 is likely to see another significant rationalisation of the news media industry. Also of note is the negative effect chasing digital clicks has had on the psyche of news organisations and their staff. The industry has long had an obsession with finding a magic bullet. At one stage, that was going to be blogs, then it was Twitter, then recently was video and podcasts, with everything optimised for mobile. But if you're really serious about providing quality news content, says Inkle's Gautam Mishra, you also need to be aware that optimising for mobile is itself problematic.
The big challenge for them, obviously, is that with a smaller screen, you can't have as many ads on a page. And so the most immediate problem that they face is that the number of ads they have available to sell decrease quite dramatically as a reader moves from either a printed newspaper or a large screen like on a desktop or laptop onto a mobile phone. The second problem you have is that on mobile devices, the price of advertising is lower, and that's primarily because those prices are essentially anchored by or set by what Google and Facebook can afford to charge. And so with their superior scale and not having to pay the cost of producing content, you know, the challenge for publishers is around making a model that works just off advertising. And it's really, you know, if you look at the large publishers, most of them, and you look at their cost, you very quickly get to absurd levels of audience required to make the model work. You know, you've got some of the world's biggest publishers now with 80, 90 million readers who can't cover the cost of producing their journalism. I'd say that's probably the biggest issue for publishers. But the secondary issue is, I think, the way we use our devices, which is less in terms of longer, more considered consumption of content, with newspapers obviously being one extreme where you really sort of sit down and you take your time to properly absorb the information in the newspaper and read articles, as opposed to on mobile where you're constantly distracted, you're in a noisy environment, be it a train or a bus or standing in line for lunch, and you're glossing over very rapid streams of information that are coming up on your phone's home screen. So I think, you know, societally, there's a danger here that we're becoming more and more shallow in our depth of understanding of different issues.
Which goes to the Canadian media theorist Marshall McLuhan's famous statement that the medium is the message, that the medium begins to dictate the nature of the message over time.
Yes, absolutely. So in the mobile context, there are a lot of articles that are shorter. A lot of publishers will actually just show you the first two paragraphs and then you have to click a button to read more. And they're essentially doing that because a lot of people get bored now after reading the first two paragraphs of an article, so they want to just move on to the next article. The publishers realize this and make it easier to do. But the end result of it all is that, you know, fewer and fewer of us actually reading articles all the way through and really understanding what's happening. And in its stead is a rapid-fire debate on places like Twitter, where you'll see hundreds of people commenting on an article with the realization that almost none of them have actually bothered to read the article they're debating. So I think that's where, you know, there's a danger because really, I mean, with the world getting more complicated, there is a need to understand the issues that we're debating and we're discussing rather than just the headlines.
Gautam Mishra, the CEO of Inkle. We also heard today from Matthew Ingram, the chief digital writer at the Columbia Journalism Review, and Gabrielle Boland, content strategy and communications manager at Newswhip in New York. I'm Anthony Fennell. Thanks to the other members of the team, Karin Savanovitz and Dave White. Until next week on Future Tense, cheers.